in Albany. How do you size that up?
Well, the plans were for support, as I said, here with generous. The problem in those, in the early on in some of those years, was that the budget was, the support was delayed in a sense. There were periods in which there was retrenchment involved in it. And so,
was this after Rockefeller?
Yes. And now, a college president looking at his university president, looking at all his responsibilities, wants to distribute resources the way he sees. The vice president for health sciences sees this as a line item in the budget, and the legislative intent was to give the money to him, and he would naturally resent seeing that go somewhere else. On the other hand, when Ed became the university president, I dare say he behaved in very much the same fashion. So I was understanding of that. There was also the issue of the fact that we were over-financed, in a sense, during our startup period. We couldn't possibly fill all the positions at the rate that they were awarded us. And so that provided a pillow for some backup for what John Toll saw as university needs. And as a matter of fact, there was, we always felt a constant flow of about $2 million of faculty support that the campus used while we were not using it. Unfortunately, for John Mauberger, that the bill came due, in that we reached the point where we needed that money and we needed those jobs, and that impacted on his ability to use that money for otherwise campus needs. On the other hand, we were also generating enormous sums of money. The practice plan now generates about $40 million a year.
And you say the practice plan?
The clinical practice plan. Clinical income for taking care of patients.
I see.
Now, on the other hand, the hospital costs about, well, it must cost about $150 million, I would guess. It was $120 when I left the dealership. So it must be somewhere around $150 million a year. And that...
In costs.
In
operating costs.
Yes, and that is not made up by income. And so the state has subsidizes and keeps squeezing on that. I think that Jack Mauberger, for instance, has had much greater problems financially than we did early on. When I started as the dean, it was the ideal time to be a dean. A chairman would come into my office and say, I need another assistant professor. I would say, fine, hire him. As I looked at my table of organization, he had that. We were planning for that job. We had the finances. Someone would come in and say, well, we need an electron microscope. And I would say, do you really need it? Yes. What are you going to do with it? And so forth. Buy it. We had $16 million in equipment plant, right? So I think the problem now is that if there's, within the university, if there's competition for funds, one of the techniques of leadership is, in universities, particularly in faculty, is to make the decision but give people the sense that they're taking part in the planning process and that they understand what the needs are. I was insistent when we were redid, for instance, in the distribution of overhead income that was returned to us. We began to develop a very large piece of the research activities of the campus were located there naturally, and so we had one of the larger costs. And it was I had no problem deciding immediately that we would be happy to see part of our money diverted to social sciences, to the arts, which always lag behind in that kind of availability of funds to research. Because we wanted to be part of a university. If we wanted to operate alone, then we didn't belong in a university. I said, if we started it, insist that money go to us, it's the syndrome that I call goodbye degree. You can't support
goodbye,
a university.
Goodbye degree.
Greek. You can't support those kinds of the disciplines unless everybody at the university is willing to contribute. So, but it was what I liked about it was that we were asked about it and consulted it. As a matter of fact, one of the people I appreciated for that reason and continue to appreciate was Sidney Gelman's role as the academic vice president in those years. He was extraordinarily supportive and gave us a real sense of being part of the university. Well,
he had good training at Columbia, and he also had his musical interests, which carried over. Okay. Well, you've been talking also about nine.
I guess.
Let me ask you about a couple of people who are no longer here. One was Eliot, and another one was the chap who went to North Shore Jewish. I've forgotten his name as the administrator. He was administrator here, I think, before Eliot.
No. Oh, I know who you mean. No, he didn't go to North Shore. He went to Jewish. Long Island Jewish. But he...
Yes.
Well, let me see. No, he went...
What was his
no,
name?
No, he didn't. He went... He became... Peter...
Peter Rogatz.
Rogatz.
Yeah.
No, Peter... Peter left for a very a good reason from his point of view. He didn't see the hospitals coming along fast enough for him, and he, as a matter of fact, when he came back to visit and he saw this thing going up, when it was open finally, he said, "My God," he said, "they really built it." Because we had periods of time where it wasn't clear that they were going to build this hospital. It went up. Down, Ed came back from Albany, would say, "Well, we're going to do a 200-bed hospital." And I said, "Nonsense, you may as well not do anything." When they opened the new Nassau County Medical Center, which is a beautiful building, it's a Cadillac of a facility. And we weren't sure we were going to get a hospital here. I went to the administrators there and I said, "Suppose the state offered to buy this building for you for $1. And take over the mortgage." They were in debt, $80 million. They said, "Fine." I came back, and some of the people who had contacted said they were going to talk to Maggiotta.
Yeah. He was the Republican leader for Nassau.
I came back here and talked to the Oaks and to Toll. They thought I was out of my mind with the state. Take over a county hospital and with all its problems and so forth, but there was talk about using North Shore and Northport VA as the university hospital. It wasn't clear we wanted to get a university hospital, so Peter felt that he just wasn't going to hang around for that. He was at a critical stage in his career. He had been the director at Long Island Jewish before he came. And then he went to, from here, I guess he went to Blue Cross as the administrator there. And then he's now, I think, doing private, he's a private consultant for hospital management. Now, so that was why he left. As a matter of fact, I used to call him regularly every day, call his office, just to hear his telephone, his secretary answer the university hospital. There was no university hospital, but it was the office for University Hospital, but it was so pleasing to me to hear that the University Hospital was coming. I'm sorry.
What about Eliot?
No, Mike was a good friend of mine. And I never quite understood what the whole fuss about his involvement with Russo had to do with whether he was whether they were behaving properly in doing outside consulting work. And there were rules that governed this, and I thought they were operating within the rules. I think that I did not see the need for him to leave. I went and made a strong plea to Jack that he committed to stay. I think Jack felt otherwise. And I was instrumental, as a matter of fact, in getting him placed at NYU when he left here. So as a mark of my confidence in him, I thought he was a good administrator. And I still feel that way. He's now at St. Luke's. But I think it was unfortunate that we lost him, because he set up a lot of systems that were operating here. It would have been nice for him to see them come to fruition.
Wait a minute. No, we're still on. I want to see the little red thing. I don't want to run over.
Okay. I think you've done 10.
I've done well.
Pretty well.
So.
And you want to try 12 a little bit? How have the expectations with which you came worked out personally for you?
Well, I came with the idea of being chairman of the Department of Pathology. And indeed, when Ed realized after 2 years, after the school had been open for some 2 years, that he couldn't carry all the positions that he was operating in, which were vice president for health sciences, dean of the School of Medicine, professor and chairman of the Department of Medicine, and began to apportion those responsibilities. He came to me and said, "You be the dean." And I said, "I don't want to be the dean. I'm happy being in the chairman of the Department of Pathology. I have a good department, a good little department. It's going to get larger, and we have some great people that I've been happy to see come here." And he said, "No, no, you be the dean." It was sort of totally
thrust upon you.
Now that may be a good way to become the dean when you don't want the job. I think perhaps that's the only way to be the dean of medicine. And I continued on for 15 years after that, so I guess I must have found it satisfying. But it was sort of amusing when I had my first faculty meeting. I said to them, "Okay, I'm the dean. What can I do for you?" Because I saw the dean as a kind of facilitator.
Right.
And the professor of physiology said, "Get the goddamn dog out of the classroom." I said, "What? Is that what the dean is supposed to do?" Well, the first class that we took had a dog, and they adopted a pet dog that came to classes with them. And he was annoyed by this. The professor of anatomy, however, Maynard Dewey, said, "Wait a minute now." He said, "I lecture by walking back and forth on the podium." He said, "I tripped over that dog 3 times today. I turned to the dog and said, 'Would you please go to the back of the room?' And the dog got up and went to the back of the room." He said, "Don't throw him out. He's the only one that's listening to me." Well, the first class, one of the reasons I think that Ed came to the conclusion that somebody else ought to be the dean right away was that they were an extraordinary group. And that's true of starting classes in any new medical school. I found subsequently that was true in all the new schools that started, because...
What was true?
Well, that they were unusual for medical school class, and they were unusual in this way.
Oh, students.
Students,
yes.
Students were, because at that time getting into medical school was intensely competitive. And so students that were accepted in this school and in other schools often had multiple acceptances because they were so extra outstanding. But then say to yourself, what kind of student then elects to come to a brand new school without clinical facilities when they've gotten into three other schools that have an established track record that they know can turn out physicians? By the way, were obviously students who felt that they knew how to educate a physician, and they were coming here to tell us how they should be educated. And so it was a tough job dealing with them, and they were constantly in Pellegrino's office, and he had enough of that. He said, when he said, you be the dean, he meant you deal with the students in addition to recruiting the rest of the faculty.
How did you handle it?
Well, I think I had more time to be a kind of father image. Ed was busy running around and negotiating with Albany and with the legislature and with the administration, and he had...
He was the only person who ever addressed the legislature from this like this.
True. I don't know. We appeared before legislative committees, but not before the legislature. And Ed, so that the sense I was able to give the students that I was personally involved in this enterprise with them. For instance, we had no way of exposing them to autopsies when we were teaching pathology, and they got to the second year. I would take groups of them, 10 of them, in a station wagon, to drive them to the medical examiner's office in Hopewell, demonstrate a case to them, get back in the station wagon with them, and drive back. Yeah, well, they I think, appreciated that sense of involvement. And also, then, I was in closer contact, perhaps, than he could be, with their other instructors in other disciplines, in biochemistry and physiology, and could transmit their insecurities and their concerns, their expectations of what instruction should be like to them. Not always, not that they were correct, but that they had this sense of inchoate longing for,
inchoate,
yeah, for participation in design. This group had come to maturity in the 60s. So that was a happy part of the experience. I used to receive, I have a collection of petitions from all kinds of problems. Incredible. Like, one year the girls in the class decided that they should be the subjects for learning, teaching how vaginal examination is done. And I said, my God, whatever for? Why do you want to do that? And they said, well, we want the men in the class to understand that there's an in-person around this apparatus, and that how they relate to it, to the person is an important part of the teaching. And then at the end of the year, they sent me a letter saying what a gratifying experience this was, and so forth. So that didn't last terribly long. But it was that kind of thing. Or they didn't like the way this was taught, or that was taught. So. Meanwhile, we had the opportunity to recruit a faculty, and that was great. So, the expectations when I came were not to be the dean. They were to be the chairman of pathology. Fortunately, I had a number of talented people that came here with me. There was a skeleton crew that came from NYU, like Fred Miller and Bernie Lane.
Bernie Lane.
And Ed.
I want to get this on.
And Aaron Janoff.
Yeah.
And Mildred Phillips. Phil Kane. Those that all had been with me at, spent some time with me at NYU, Leon Sokolov, who had been a colleague and a classmate and colleague up until 1952, when he went to the NIH, then came back here to join us, and that was a great delight. So we really had a very talented core group in pathologies, and they were perfectly able to carry on without me when I became. My concept of what a dean did was largely drawn from two things. Well, one was that a dean was had some ceremonial responsibilities. The other thing, however, was that in the period of time I had been at NYU, which was a long time, in a fairly responsible position, I had served on most of the operating committees of a medical school. I had been on the curriculum committee. I had been on the student aid. I had chaired the student aid committee. I had been on the admissions committee. Those committees, which are the faculty's, the way in which the faculty really takes part in the governance of the school and our advisory to the dean, I had that kind of experience. And now that I look back on it, that perhaps was the most valuable training I had for a deanship, not being chairman of the department, not necessarily teaching myself, but having, in addition to that, been having functioned as a faculty representative to the administration, so I knew what, I had an idea about what I would require in the way of support from the administration. And I think we had a kind of happy dean's office. It was a very good time for the school.
The chronology of that was, let me have it again.
I came here in 1970 as chairman of the Department of Pathology. In 1972, I took over as the dean.
I see.
And I was dean and chairman of the Department of Pathology for 2 years, but I was clear that the responsibilities in pathology were being carried by the people who were over here, so that in 1974, I think Fred Miller became officially the chairman of the Department of Pathology, and I continued as dean until 1987.
Okay. Good.
Well, I say I had no real expectations of dean, but it was, I would say, 15 years of very satisfying experience. There were bad days, of course. Thought everything was going wrong, the faculty was unhappy. But overall, I would say that I found it most fulfilling and satisfying. Have a real sense of almost paternal sense of that.
Personal fulfillment.
I might say, just as an example, for instance, I didn't agonize a bit at it over the decision as to whether to go to Harvard or not. And I had some good friends up there too. And it's a good school. They tell me.
How has Howard Oakes worked out?
Howard and I have had an interesting relationship. When it was clear that Ed was leaving and we had to pick a successor to him, I thought Howard would do extraordinarily well, because he had been here from early on, one of the earliest people, understood the workings of the school, the workings of the Albany hierarchy, got on well with the administration here. Medical school deans very often resent academic vice presidents. And I told this to Howard. I said, Howard, now looking back over the time we've spent together, I want you to know that the relationship between a vice president and for health sciences and the medical school is often not a happy one, because they see themselves in competing, in a sense, for direction of the medical school. And in principle, I would continue to be opposed to having to report to a vice president for health sciences rather than directly to the president. Actually, in terms of our relationship, it has been absolutely no problem. And I think Howard has never tried to tell me how to run the medical school. He did not. And concerned himself with the kinds of things that I think would have distracted me if I had to worry about it, or I had to engage the individuals involved. And so we've had a very happy relationship, and both on the professional and on the personal level.
Basic understanding?
Pleasant affair. Well, it's been more than that. It's been a real collaborative effort, I would say. And I believe, for instance, that the dean should be the vice president for health. The dean of medicine should be the vice president for health sciences. But I didn't feel I had to be that with Howard. Howard here. So he did a lot of the onerous management of things like social welfare and allied health industry and whatnot that I would not have enjoyed, but would have had to assign to other people to do if I had had both positions. On the other hand, what I did for him was give him a peaceful and happy medical school growing over 15 years, which may become harder and harder to do as this becomes more and more settled. But so we had a good relationship.
Yep.
And we continue to have it.
Okay, let me just, I want to go to the other side now, I think, on this. All right, go ahead.
I had an idea that I'd like to do something like what you're doing. And I, some time ago, and I got this very elaborate, this very elegant book I bought. And then I wrote something. It says, I am completing my 14th year at Stony Brook. I have always meant to keep some sort of record of the events that attended the founding of this school of medicine. 14 years have gone by, and now it's all in my head, distorted, I'm sure, by the passage of time, but perhaps less distorted by the passions of each moment. What I can recall will be recorded together with an ongoing account. I shall try to mix reminiscences with records. Now, I never did that, but I started here by saying, I start then. On Thursday, April 12, 1984, I shall not be as precise about date and time for most of what I have to say, but this special day is the termination of the fifth accreditation of the school by the LCME, the Liaison Committee on Medical Education. The liaison was between the AAMC, the American Association of Medical Colleges, and the AMA, in which it's the fifth one in which I have taken part. I shall have something to say about the preceding ones, but let me stay with this one for the present. I am writing this at 8 o'clock in the morning. In half an hour, we shall have the accrediting team's evaluation of our program. I have some trepidation, but it is not accompanied by the real anxiety that attended our previous accreditation. I believe firmly, perhaps blinded by my own conceits, that we have a real success story here. Will the visitors perceive this school in the same light? Or will they feel we have not done enough with our opportunity? Or will they accept what we have done, even offer approval, but continue to limit that approval with certain contingencies, hoping by this tactic to be helpful to us in continuing to pressure the state to completing the assignment of support to school and hospital? I hope they won't adopt this tactic. I believe in the state's ultimate commitment to our full development. I think what we need now is a real triumph. Well, we'll see. I shall follow this with notes on their exit interview remarks. Well, I never did any more with this. I might say, by the way, that they were very enthusiastic. The accreditors said, finally, they saw this not simply as one of the, as a good medical school, but as potentially a great medical school. And they were very complimentary about the role of the people. But I never carried on with my with the kind of thing that as I say that you're doing, my sense of what went on at the school. It probably would take hours and hours to.
Well, now tell you what I'd like to suggest then. Jerry has one secretary in his office who is, among other things, transcribing these tapes. The work goes slowly, but I think I'd like to have her transcribe what we have and send you a copy, and you take it from there as a help to you and doing what you'd like to do.
Yeah, that'd be fine. I hope I can catch up.
I'm going to retire, I guess, in August. I will be 70.
I see.
And but I hope to maintain an office.
Well, I hope you can.
And I'm right now. I'm getting a great deal of delight out of running the autopsy service, which I do, and doing surgical conferences, and teaching still. I would guess I will turn the autopsy service over to one of the younger men.
One of my memories, I started at Wesleyan as a pre-medical student. One of my memories was being invited by a family friend, Clarence Gamble, one of the three Gamble brothers of Procter & Gamble, who was Harvard Medical. And was at Harvard Medical. He invited me. I was in Newton, and while I was in high school, I went to MGH and sat in on one of the autopsies. Watched this chap smoking a tremendous cigar going through one of the autopsies. Made quite an impression on me.
Who was it, do you remember? Was it Tracy Mallory? He was a cigarette smoker, I think.
Well, this was a long time back.
This was in the teens. His father was there before him, Frank Mallory. And they named the Mallory Institute at Boston City after him.
I see.
But,
it could well have been.
Were you intrigued by it?
I was intrigued. I ran into the sciences, and while I didn't do badly, they didn't grab me, and I became more and more interested in history, and finally majored in history, did honors work in history.
See, my father, and that's his diploma, graduated from City College in 1911, and then had intended to go to medical school and was accepted at Cornell, which was, in those days, at 28th Street. And in the first day he went to medical school, he walked into the anatomy lab where they were dissecting, looked around, walked right out, and registered in law school.
You should go ahead with what you want to do.
Well, I won't. That has nothing to do with it. There are probably more things I can tell you that would be of interest to you in terms of the early faculty, and I would like to do it, but I'm afraid not now.
All right. Okay.
And
something else to do.
And if we can make another appointment, perhaps, that would be...
All right.
I think some of the people who came on early and who helped build this place certainly deserve being recorded.
Right.
And I'd like to do that.
I'd like Ed suggested that I try to find Goodson and...
Ed Pellegrino.
Yeah.
Yeah, good. Because he had a lot to do with the design, I think. I don't know what his sense of the... One of the important evolutionary things here was the disappearance of the School of Basic Sciences.
Disappearance?
Yeah, because after a while we merged it with the School of Medicine, and now it is that. It's important in part because of... Well, there were differences that developed about the whole future of life sciences generally, and still unresolved differences here at Stony Brook, which we'll have to come to some resolution. There were facets of this which I have found particularly intriguing, because I was absolutely naive in my dealing with
with the campus, the rest of the campus.
Well, let's take that up some other time.
All right.
All right, let me get it down then on your calendar.
Talking about the organization of life sciences.
Right.
So I'll say a few words about that and then go on to Brookhaven. I think Claude Kerr, some years ago, pointed out that higher education in the United States had gone through several periods in which the university really met the needs of the country as it as they developed and changed, so that there was a period of time when the land-grant schools were expanding and providing aid to agriculture and educating farmers. And then, as the population grew, there was a great need for teachers, and so the universities and colleges turned their attention to what ordinarily was the province of normal schools, and turned out lots of teachers. We went through a period where the natural sciences were preeminent because of the needs of industry, chemistry and physics. And he was talking he was saying this in 1970, and he saw this as the next few decades being the era of health services as being a major societal need, and that the universities would turn toward this. Now, as a state school and bellwether for education in the state, I think that Stony Brook was preeminently in a position to provide those kinds of that kind of higher education. And as a matter of fact, I suspect that's what Ed Pellegrino had in mind when he would talk about a university of the health sciences. Well, of course, this wasn't entirely acceptable to the more classically minded people on the campus, and it wasn't that we wanted to destroy liberal education. On the contrary, I think that health sciences require preeminently the basic education in arts and in the liberal arts. But we saw that the funding and the appeal of the university would in part be, maybe in large part, be dependent upon how we were perceived by the people in the legislature fulfilling certain societal needs, and that these were so very much in the way of provision of health care. The expectations of the population of people had grown in regard to what they wanted from their health caretakers. The that portion of the national product which was going into health sciences was increasing. People were living longer, and they wanted to live longer, younger. We thought we had something very special to offer, and that this, coupled with the acknowledgement of the requirement, perhaps more than in any other groups of professions, for a liberal arts background, was what offered us the opportunity to join with certain parts of the university in a tighter kind of organizational pattern.
Right.
I felt then, and I feel now, perhaps, that there is so much in common between
all life sciences, but we don't talk about human biology now, we talk about biology. Molecular biology encompasses everything from one-celled plants to, or even below that, to from viruses to dinosaurs to humans. And that the methods that are used in research in biomedical science now are the methods that are used in organic chemistry and biochemistry and all of the fields that concern themselves with living things. Mm-hmm. Seem like a waste of resources to have the old organization into undergraduate and graduate biology departments and then medical school departments, and I still feel that way, even though I perceive that we make the campus nervous by seeming to be expansile, perhaps, in our wishes to control everything. When I spoke with some of these ideas, and I heard some of the sociologists here say, well, you see that's a new power base that's developing. I said, I don't even know what you're talking about. But I never thought in terms of power bases, or I just thought in terms of educational missions, how they overlapped and how they could be added to. Well, I think that remains to be worked out. It may in part be dependent upon a striking reorganization in medical education. It seems to us now that there's very little difference between the kinds of talents that we hire in biochemistry departments and pharmacology departments and microbiology departments, even in anatomy departments or cell biology departments. They all do the same thing, use the same techniques, address the same problems. Mm-hmm. And just to duplicate departments and yet call them different disciplines is a sort of kind of adoration of the past, which has little meaning. Indeed, most departments of physiology don't teach classical organ physiology anymore. It's taught by the clinicians. Physiologists are more interested in membranes and channels and potentials than they are in renal filtration rates or cardiac output. Yet somebody has to teach that. And the pharmacologists aren't really interested in materia medica anymore. They're interested, in cell-xenobiotic interactions, but not in therapeutics, how you dose it, a sick patient. So we have to rearrange our thinking in that regard. But this, too, was part of the particular appeal of Stony Brook, in that I felt that we were less tied to the old disciplines and what had been done before, and what we always did it this way. You know, we can't do it any other way, because we've always done it this way, and we always did it this way well. And I still have hopes that kind of reorganization can come about. I must say, thinking back, I was startled at the extent of the opposition I ran into when I tried to combine neurobiology with physiology. However, some of the faculty were prepared to accept it, indeed were enthusiastic about it. Others were very concerned about loss of identity. It requires a kind of academic leadership, I think, that sometimes has to mandate those changes without being too sensitive to the faculty's concerns about
self-interest?
Well, self-interest and security and their perception of their own place and all those things which relate to individual fates and not the fate of the institution.
Did you know Mel Simpson?
Oh, yes.
How does his work dovetail in any way with what you people are doing?
Yes, Mel is a classical biochemist, and I think would be very insistent that biochemistry is a very specific discipline that calls for its own way of life, almost.
I don't know how Mel would feel now looking ahead to how biochemistry was going to develop. Biochemistry has triumphed. Biochemists don't have to worry. They've taken over. Everybody's a biochemist now. So. Mel's particular interest, which as I recall was in mitochondrial DNA, is the same thing that they're interested in five other departments.
Okay.
The problem for us is that this biomedical science has made such advances, there's been such an explosion of information, that we are now really in a quandary about how much we need, we expect a physician to know, and how much, how do we make the separation now?